Today is January the 9th, 2019. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. I'm a little bit under the weather today, so my voice a little gruff and, well, accept my apologies. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who's using your personal data besides Facebook and Google? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, as well as on various podcast hosting sites. We will start to use different formats to engage you, the listeners. If you find it inconvenient, for whatever the reasons may be, to hear a live broadcast of the Personal Computer Show using a computer, you can receive us with just a simple telephone without Internet access or frills. Let's say you have, as most people now have on their cell phone plan, unlimited minutes 24/7 in all 50 states. You can listen to the program live via telephone landline or on the Internet on Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. You don't need a computer to hear the program. The call number to live listen is 641-793-7091 at 6 p.m. Eastern Time each Wednesday. I know, that's a mouthful. Let me repeat that. 641-793-7091. I wonder if anyone can conjure some kind of anagram or acronym with those numbers. You can send us via email your questions and or opinions to hank at pcradioshow.org, and we will contact you and record a chat with you and use it for a future broadcast. And if you are shy, we can just take your question and opinions via email, and we'll just say it came from an anonymous caller. For those who are listening to the program on demand, you can leave us a message on the telephone with your question or comment to hank at pcradioshow.org. You can also reach us on the Google number 862-800-6805. That Google number is 862-800-6805. And you start your message with the Personal Computer Show, followed by your message. And when I'm feeling better next week, I'm going to start receiving call-ins during the live program itself. And the call-in number that I would start receiving questions or comments next week is 888-874-4888. Let me repeat that number. Starting next week, I'll be accepting live phone calls during the live broadcast on 888-874-4888. In October, the city partnered with Freelancers Union to open the Freelancers Hub in Brooklyn. It's a kind of a communal co-working space that offers classes, tax and legal advice, or at no cost to the city's growing population of freelance workers. The Freelancers Union is located at 30 John Street in Brooklyn, New York, and the hours are from Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. by prior appointment. And their website is freelancershub.nyc. If you go onto their website for the month of January, at least what's remaining in January, there are four special events that's been scheduled between 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. On January 15th, from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m., they have a special event, Freelancers Benefits Consultations. On January 17th, from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m., how do you go about rebranding yourself and how do you fit in by standing out? January 29th, they have a special events Freelancers Benefits Consultation again from 9 to 5. In other words, that's repeated from the 15th if you missed the 15th. And on the 30th, from 5 p.m. to 7 p.m., if you go onto their website, they have different sessions scheduled, and it's by RSVP, and you can then sign up for them. A little more about the organization. The goal of the Freelance Hub is to equip the population in the city with the skills they need, something many experts argue that traditional education isn't doing. The Hub is the first freelance-focused workforce training program of its kind in the country. Its existence is in response to massive changes in the labor force. Thanks in part to the expansion of gig work apps, growth in freelance and contract work is far outpacing growth in full-time employment. But those workers also don't receive benefits, on-the-job training, or other services traditionally offered by employers. This is of particular concern to New York City, which estimates freelance make up 38% of its workforce. That's a very high number. More than a third of the workforce in the city are freelance workers. That's a number that's going to continue to rise with the growth and advent of on-demand apps and other structural changes in the economy, says Julie Menin, who is the New York City Commissioner for Media and Entertainment. In less than 3 months, from October to now, the Hub has signed up 4,000 members. One of the people who have gone through the training said they don't really prepare you for a career, he says. They don't really say, all right, this is how you go out there and make money and support yourself. So until the Hub open, you teach yourself how to create websites, set prices, and negotiate and write contracts. They're located in Brooklyn, 30 John Street, alongside the Independent Filmmakers Project. The Hub is targeted at freelancers in creative fields where work is most competitive: design, photography, film, and writing. It looks like a basic open office with rows of desks, couches, and small tables. Hub members can also access a small theater and classrooms where workshops on topics like personal finance, benefits, and its most popular, stress management, takes place. This new program aims to train the growing freelance workforce. Its time has come where, as the population ages, many people who are past the age of 50, and if they've been recently laid off or outsourced, it's very difficult to find work, and this is a subject of ageism that no politicians has taken up. His name is Benjamin Rockwell. He's the host of Computer Talk Radio, and he has been working with computers professionally for years. Benjamin started learning computers when he was a pre-teenager, and in his first class in computing, it was a Commodore VIC-20, and he hasn't stopped working with computers since.
Technology in the workplace is abundant. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now I'm going to put on my work hat. I'm going to talk about those things that you hear at the office, but you're maybe not sure about the deeper aspects. Today, I'm going to be talking about how the world of the IT professional delivers something called a virtual private network, or VPN. So what is a VPN? What is a virtual private network? So let's start off with, you have the network at your office. You have a number of computers that are all connected together. Now, this is something that's evolving. Some people that are listening right now, you may have access to the office from home through one of these virtual private networks, as if you were actually in the office. And you may not. It's kind of varying here and there. But let's take that network at the office. So we've got all of the computers. Let's say there are 10 computers and one server. There's just 10 users at the office and one big, huge server that has all of the data there. Now, it is protected by something called a firewall. This firewall prevents the bad guys from getting into the office, into the network. It's that locked door. It is the receptionist at the front desk. It's that door to keep them going further into the factory or whatever kind of office you have. You've got the idea there. So that firewall sits there and it protects everything. Now, wouldn't it be great if we had a side entrance to get onto the network that was still protected? It still had like this big, huge, burly security guard there. And it said, hold on, I'm not sure you should go in. Oh, wait, here, we've got your various authentication stuff. We've got your, here's your name, here's your whatever it is, your computer access codes. And oh, yeah, we're not actually going to let you in. You're going to be able to do all of your work from outside just by using secret codes. That's your encryption. So that's what we've got here. We have the ability for you to get onto the network from home. What it does is it sets up this tunnel. That's what we call it. It is an encrypted tunnel, and sometimes we will refer to this as a tunneling protocol. And that is where on your computer at home, or your laptop that you take home, or whatever it is, or via remote, your system has a software. And this software takes and encrypts, it codes all of the information that is going between your home and the office. Great. On the other end of the office, they decode it and they encode information that's going back to you. So it's perfectly secure there. All of the information that's going between point A and point B, point A being your home, point B being the office, it's all encrypted. Bingo. Great. Now, with the virtual private network, it's as if you are in the office. It's as if you are sitting there right at the systems that are in the office. Now, it's going to be slower. Why is it slower? Because all of the systems in the office are directly connected. It's a higher speed access in the office. Now, there are ways around this. There are a multitude of ways around this. One of them is by virtualization. You may connect up from your system at home to a software that is remote controlling a computer or a terminal at the office. It's still encrypted, and now there's an encrypted remote control tunnel that's going over the encrypted VPN connection, virtual private network connection. So you're doubly secure there. Now, it's also faster because that virtualization, we talked about this a few weeks ago, that virtualization allows you to remote control that system as if you were sitting in front of it, and yet all of that information is sitting there, and it's dealing with the servers a lot faster. You can save files faster. You can search through files faster. You can access everything faster through that virtualization. Again, made more secure by a virtual private network. It's exciting stuff. I like this. You may have it so just the top officers of the company have access, or maybe everybody has access, and that's the beauty of it. It's fully scalable. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin.
The following is a postscript to Benjamin Rockwell's segment on VPN. Onavo, O-N-A-V-O, is a VPN, and their parent company is Facebook. Onavo was acquired by Facebook in October of 2013. Facebook has leveraged Onavo's analytic platform to monitor the performance of its competitors, target companies for acquisition, and make other business decisions. Media outlets classify Onavo as spyware. In August of 2018, Facebook removed Onavo Protect from the App Store in response to a request from Apple. So you can't trust all VPNs.
What do you do when your computer seems to be running with a mind of its own? There are apps when installed that refuses to be uninstalled. There are instances when your Windows operating system appears to be running out of control. You run the registry cleaner. You clean up extraneous files with Crap Cleaner or CCleaner. It didn't help at all. Your first step is to do a system restore to a date prior to the date of the problem. If you did not have the saving the system restore point set on, well, then you've had a teachable lesson. In most cases, it does solve the problem. But what if that doesn't fix the problem? What's next? You go to Plan B. Use the system file checker tool that's built into Windows to repair missing or corrupted system files. If some Windows functions aren't working or Windows crashes, use the system file checker to scan Windows and restore your files. How do you do it? Well, get into command mode in administrative mode and then run system file checker, that's SFC. That's SFC space / scan now. I'll repeat that again. SFC space / scan now and then you press enter. This will take a while to run. Just be patient. Go out and have a mug of coffee. Wait a minute, change that to a carafe full of coffee. I've run SFC on computers and it either returns a report of no problems or it reports it has found problems and fixed them. In rare cases, it does report corruption found and not able to do a fix. When that happens, you go to Plan C. Microsoft has a Fixit utility. Just do a search in the URL typing the following: Microsoft space fix space it space tool. I'll repeat it again. It's Microsoft Fix It tool. If you're not on the computer that has the problem, just save the troubleshooter to a flash drive and then run it on the computer that has the problem. What does this fix? Corrupted registry keys on a 64-bit operating system. Corrupted register keys that control the update data. Problems that prevent new programs from being installed. Problems that prevent existing programs from being completely uninstalled or updated. Problems that block you from uninstalling a program through add or remove programs or programs and features in the control panel. If the problem persists, then go to Plan D, which is to rebuild the operating system. By the way, you did do backup on your data on a regular basis, right? Let's say you need to reinstall the Windows operating system. When you purchase a system today, the distribution version of the operating system is stored in hidden partitions. If it was a Windows 10 operating system on the computer, a factory reset will get you back to the release version of Windows 10 at the time of purchase. After the reinstallation over time, your computer will be upgraded to the latest version of Windows 10. You will need only to reinstall the applications originally on the system with the associated data from your backup files. But what if the factory reset gets you back to Windows 7, which you had subsequently upgraded to Windows 10? The free upgrade of Windows 7 to 10 from Microsoft terminated at the end of 2016. There were Microsoft Windows build releases, version 1507, 1511, and 1607, prior to the beginning of 2017. If you have downloaded any one of those releases, you can still do a free upgrade of Windows 7 to Windows 10. These Windows 10 build versions are still available from Microsoft, but at a price. They are available from third-party sources, free. One site is windowsiso.net. That's windowsiso.net. Even if you don't need it today, but the hidden partitions is Windows 7, download the appropriate build release before Microsoft formally requests third-party sites to cease distribution. The downloaded file is in ISO or image format. When you open the ISO file in Windows 10, you have opened a subdirectory of all the files in the Windows 10 distribution. Copy these files onto a USB drive and run the setup.exe to upgrade your Windows 7 to 10. You can run a clean install instead of the upgrade if you have the Windows 7 product code. What if you had mislaid the product 7 product code? What do you do then? And you don't have it readily available. Simple. Download the program Magical Jelly Bean, and when you run that program, it will tell you what the product code is, but do this before you begin any upgrade or reinstallation of Windows 10. What do you do when your system can't start up cleanly or it just doesn't turn on? Last Wednesday, I had finished editing the weekly broadcast at about 2 a.m. in the morning, and there was a message that Windows Update would start up. I opted to let the Windows Update proceed as I was tired. I did not back up the completed broadcast. I just went to sleep. I woke up at about 8 a.m. and got back onto the system. The system booted up asking for the Windows password. I had none to begin with. Only option was entering the password or click on I forgot password. Each time I clicked on I forgot password, I received a message to enter password or click on I forgot password. Each time I turned off the machine and restarted, the same message popped up on the screen. I went into action on Plan A to get the system up and running. I tried booting up with warm restart, on a number of occasions to no avail, and now it was time to go into Plan B. I pulled out the Windows installation distribution to do an initial system boot, and I selected the Windows System Restore option. There were about 9 different points of options available for me to use. I went through each restore attempt, and it failed. I wasn't flustered yet. I just moved on to Plan C. Next option was to restore to the previous build. Unfortunately, the previous build was corrupted. Well, I next tried to do a factory reset without losing data. Murphy's Law was in effect. It was not possible to do a clean system install without erasing the data. I had just spent 3 hours trying to retrieve the data, and the clock was ticking. So, rather than spend any more time on it, I called Microsoft support. The technician suggested all the steps I had gone through. His final recommendation was just do a factory reset, forget about any data being available. According to him, there was no other option. But in the back of my mind, I always had a last resort. I removed the hard disk drive from the notebook in question and installed the hard drive into an external enclosure. This in turn was connected to another system I had available. This enabled me to recover last week's broadcast. When you are removing any component part from a notebook, just remember to disconnect the AC power and remove the battery from the unit first. What lessons were to be learned? Well, turn off the automatic Windows update and do the manual update, and don't feel bad that you're not doing an update immediately as soon as it's released. In fact, I would hold off until there's no other complaints on it. There had been a lot of complaints about the Windows 10 update, release 1807. Make sure your system restore for the drive C is on, because that's where your operating system is. And in my case, I had on hand a spare external enclosure, and if you don't have one, you can get one for about $10 at Micro Center so that you can move the hard or solid-state drive into that enclosure. Also have available a Windows 10 distribution media available. If you don't have it, there is a website you can go to. It's called windowsiso.net. That's one word, windowsiso.net. They have many of the 7, 8, 8.1, and 10 distributions of Windows available. In my case, for Windows 10, I keep the releases that were in 2015 and 2016. I don't necessarily have to worry about keeping up to date on 17 and 18. Reasons are very simple. If you install Windows from 2015 or 2016, it would do a free upgrade of 7 or 8.1 to Windows 10. If you use the later ones, it won't. Download the hardware maintenance manual so you know how to open up the unit to remove the hard disk drive. If you do not or are unable to get a clean boot, try restore to a prior system restore point that was working. If unsuccessful, try all other restore points. If that is unsuccessful, then restore to a prior build. If that is unsuccessful, well, you know the drill. What if you're still running with Windows 7? Is the recovery process any different? Yes, there are some slight differences. The recovery program disk for Windows 7 has to be created from Windows 7 itself. If you had not created the recovery media for Windows 7, do so now. What if your system is down and you cannot create this disk? Well, find a buddy who's still running Windows 7. What if you are like most computer users? The Windows 7 installation disk is somewhere in a safe place. It is so safe you don't remember where you put it. On later Windows 7 purchase units, the Windows 7 operating system distribution is in a hidden partition. In earlier units, the distribution was supplied on separate media. If you misplace your Windows 7 installation disk, which may be the actual disk that came with your PC or a retail Windows 7 installed disk that you bought separately, you can still get a copy of the Windows 7 installation distribution from Microsoft at a modest cost if you provide them with your system product code. Alternatively, you can get a free copy from windowsiso.net, or that's windowsiso.net, without providing the product code. The version of Windows 7 is also important, as
product keys will only work with certain versions of Windows. Simply launch the Start menu, right-click on Computer, and select Properties from the context menu. Of course, you can also look on the box or documentation that came with the Windows 7 purchase. If you provide Microsoft with just the product code, Microsoft will figure out what version of Windows 7 is needed based on the product key and give you links to download that version. If you don't have your product key, run the utility from magicaljellybean.com to get the info. The product code label for Windows 7 is affixed also on your system unit. It may have faded or fallen off. You can still find the product key by downloading and running the utility from magicaljellybean.com. The only other difference from the Windows 10 recovery is you need to also download a copy of the Windows 10 installation distribution. This will enable you to still upgrade Windows 7 to 10 for free if the build is 2015 or 2016. The later copies of Windows 10 will upgrade 7 to 10 only if the image of the Windows 10 upgrade is on the disk. Like many Windows 7 users, you may want to replace the hard disk drive with a solid-state drive, giving you a performance boost as well as more time to upgrade to Windows 10. Preventive hardware maintenance of computing equipment. We've been inoculated in the media about the importance of what we eat and drink. The food we ingest has a direct effect on our physical health. Similarly, the care and preventive maintenance of the computing hardware we use will operate more efficiently and we will be able to lengthen the product life cycle of the hardware. With personal computing, there is the hardware maintenance and the software maintenance of a computer system. Preventive maintenance refers to regular, routine maintenance to help keep equipment up and running, preventing any unplanned downtime and expensive costs from unanticipated equipment failure. Include hardware preventive maintenance as a procedure whenever you change the clock in the spring from standard time to daylight time, and in the fall from daylight time to standard time. Computers these days are so reliable in general that we pretty much just ignore the question of whether the surrounding environment is one in which the computer can and should operate. Especially when talking about an office environment, we usually just assume that if we're okay to be in the room, then the computer is probably fine as well. That's not a terrible assumption to start with, but there are some exceptions. If you want your equipment to last a long time and perform well, then taking environmental factors into consideration is actually something you should do. The hardware maintenance of the equipment is to run the system CPU within the range specified by the manufacturer. In general, the internal elements of the CPU has an outer operating limit of 35 to 80 degrees Celsius or 95 to 176 degrees Fahrenheit. What's the best CPU temperature? Don't let your CPU run too hot. The CPU is the processor inside your computer that's responsible for most of the day-to-day number crunching. In short, it's the part that does most of the work to make Windows and applications run. You should consider the operating range of 45 to 70 degrees Celsius or 113 to 158 degrees Fahrenheit, the absolute minimum and maximum for long periods of operation. When it senses the extreme temperatures, the CPU will shut down to prevent any damage. This is temperature operating inside the CPU and not outside of the CPU casing. You have other electronics that are affected by temperature extremes, such as memory. Back in the 1980s, when I operated a bulletin board network, I located the equipment in a spare room where there was no heat or air conditioning. The system froze up when the room temperature dropped below 40 degrees Fahrenheit. Most people will not have to worry about cold temperatures when operating the computer, but heat is a common problem in the operation of a computer system. Before the CPU shuts down, it will run slower and slower and slower. You may wonder why, when you are running the system in a room that is comfortable in temperature, that this can happen. The fan dispersing the heat inside the system unit may not be functioning properly. Most users do not realize dust builds up inside a desktop system unit as well as inside a notebook. Some are running tower systems. To not clutter desktop space, many opt to place the unit at floor level. This placement attracts more dust at this level than the desktop. Another factor are those who have pets at home. Pet hair accumulation around the fan will cause the fan to rotate at much lower RPM and in effect not be able to cool the CPU unit. Use a vacuum carefully to suck out dirt and debris or blow out the dust with a can of compressed air. If you're using compressed air, try not to blow the dust back inside the system unit. If you are able to open the desktop system unit or open the notebook to access the inside, the dust cleaning would be a simple task. The placement of a system unit should have spacing where the fan can blow out. Backing it against the wall would inhibit the fan to be effective. With desktop units, you also have connecting cables. Make sure they are not bent to a point where it's not making good contact with the connecting ports. The ideal temperature is as cool as possible, which usually means room temperature. Since a hot running CPU could cause problems ranging from unwanted system crashes to physical damage to the process itself, you can keep it cool by controlling fan speeds. Another item you should check periodically is a surge protector. The surge protector protects against sudden electrical spikes. When it happens, it will render the surge protector to be useless unless the surge protector can be reset. If you see the light blinking on the surge protector, it means it's time for replacement or you need to do a reset on the surge protector. If you live in a city like New York where there is rolling brownouts during the summer to prevent a total power shutdown, it is recommended you connect your equipment to a UPS battery backup unit. Prices have fallen sharply for this equipment. Units are available for less than $40, which is not that much more than a surge protector with reset feature. A brownout is an intentional or unintentional drop in voltage in an electrical power supply system. Intentional brownouts are used for load reduction in emergency. The reductions last for minutes or hours. The irregular power supply during the brownout can ruin your computer and other electronic devices. Electronics are created to operate at specific voltages, so any fluctuations in power, both up and down, can damage them. A UPS with voltage regulation can prevent any damage to equipment. Most modern CPUs, including AMD, have a protection feature that automatically shuts them down if they get too hot, so that actual damage is unlikely. You can check the specifications of your particular CPU, which details the maximum operating temperatures for many processors. How does one check CPU temperature? Download the program HWinfo by doing a search using the following syntax.
Download space HWinfo. That's download space HWinfo.
This program is free and it does very detailed hardware monitoring. It will monitor the CPU temperature, speed of the fan, and the life of the battery in the notebook. Temperature is very easy to dismiss because most of us don't think about it when it comes to computers. We just assume it doesn't matter when in fact it does. As long as you know when and when not to operate a computer based on temperature, you should be, well, A-OK. Also bear in mind that all computer hardware and laptops has specifications that state minimum and maximum operating temperatures, and they're usually 100% accurate, and it needs to be observed.
There's nothing like home sweet home, returning to the old homestead.
Most of my world, at least my usual world, is orbiting CES right now. In Las Vegas, where everybody is, well, when you take away the casinos and the neon lights and convention after convention, Las Vegas is, think about it, Las Vegas is smack dab in a desert. There's almost no such thing as drinking enough water there, and if you're also drinking other things, whether alcoholic or sugary, well, those things tend to increase your need for water. So among the issues for a Las Vegas homeowner, dryness is huge. Dryness makes building materials shrink and prematurely age. Then there's heat. Keeping the indoors cool is a challenge, a major challenge. Las Vegas is a place that needs to take insulation very seriously. But it's not just heat. Las Vegas also gets fairly cold. only rarely cold enough for snow to fall or accumulate, but it does drop to tens of degrees below comfy cozy. In short, you know, the temperature range is a lot like Augusta, Georgia or Fort Worth, Texas. That's very different from more northern cities like Fargo or Chicago or Buffalo. Even there, their summers get hot enough that living without air conditioning can turn dangerous. Their autumn and their spring are stormy, and winds are a major factor. Extreme cold in the winter is commonplace, and snow creates slipperiness, high weight loads on structures and trees, damage when it transitions to ice, and more. So, okay, there I was in Aiken, South Carolina, designing a single-family house in a climate that I came to realize is irrelevant to a lot of the country. Yeah, there are lots of large cities where snow is a stranger. A stranger that rarely visits. Cities like Los Angeles, Houston, Phoenix, San Antonio, San Diego, Dallas, Miami, many more. On the other hand, there are some pretty big places, where snow will always show. New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, Boston, Indianapolis, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Cleveland, and the whole blizzard belt. So a South Carolina context couldn't let me offer much of anything that would be useful to everybody else. Yeah, right now, I'm not there, I'm not in Las Vegas, I'm up in the blizzard belt, seeing what's available in an existing home that I can buy and make into the poster child for ways to retrofit it to be significantly more energy miserly and to go a significantly longer time without needing major repairs or replacements. Thanks to my 40-year house design work so far, at least I'm not starting from scratch. Now, some people think I go into all these explanations and recommendations because I'm huge on conservation. It's nice, but the things that I most want to conserve are comfort, convenience, and yeah, cash. So, for example, until you buck up your insulation, the harder and longer you have to run HVAC equipment just to get comfortable. So the more it's going to spin your meter, the higher your energy bills will be. But at the same time, the more wear and tear will get at your equipment, and the sooner you'll face the need to repair or replace something truly expensive. So anybody got a problem with the idea of being a cheapskate? I kind of enjoy the idea. Anybody not good with the idea of spending a little money now to save a lot more in the next year or so? Listen, you can be living wherever you want to live, in whatever climate it provides, and there are still measures you can take to help living there cost you less. This spring, I'll start showing you how. Next week, you may want to hear me explain a concept that I call skyscraper stew.
Thank you, Marty.
Technology in the workplace is abundant. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now is the time to put on the work hat and talk about those things that you hear at the office, but you're not quite sure about the deeper meanings. So today I'm going to look at a number of the specialties that exist within technology. First and most simple, some of the areas that you do know about, the ones that touch you the most, that of the IT service desk or the desktop manager or the server or network guys. Oh wait, you know, I should keep this gender neutral as there are women in the technology forces, but information technology managers are at about 25% female, and programmers are at about 20% of the workforce. And you may think that's a little bit biased, but broadcasting and sound engineers, the women nerds of radio, tallied around 15%. Anyways, let's go back to those specialties within the world of the computer nerd. So the IT service desk. We used to call this the help desk. You call them, you speak to them every time that you have a computer problem. Okay? Desktop technician. These are the folks that come out to your desk. They work on your system right there. They may deal with a little bit of other things outside of that realm, but for the most part, they're the ones who come out to you. The next one, the server administrator, sometimes called a systems administrator, but these people run the servers that store your information. They also run the servers that provide the web pages, the variety of computers that are behind the scenes. You might think of them as running the trucks on the information superhighway. Now, the network administrator. The network administrator is someone who knows about the different connection points between the computers, the servers, so your computer, your desktop computer, your server that you're accessing, and many of the servers at the company. Also, things like firewalls and routers and the internet and so much more. These are the guys that repair the information superhighway. They are the ones in charge of it. Next, you may be dealing with something called a database. You probably are. You probably, maybe, might not be familiar with what a database is, but there are database administrators, okay? These are people who deal with the data, the various pieces of information. When you look up a piece of information in your whatever software package that you might have, or ERP software or MRP, or you go out to the internet and you look on things like Google. If you're going to Google, you're going to a very massive database. Now, I've been saying administrator and technician, but I'm going to break down some additional terms now. All right. The reason for that is there are higher levels on each of these paths. So the technician, that's really something that's been kind of relegated to. This is just the guy who's lightly taking care of some of the simple things. We also refer to them frequently as administrators. So these are the people that keep things running from day to day. Think of your car. These are the guys that do the oil changes. They'll change the light bulbs. They'll change your windshield wipers, things like that. Then we have an engineer. The engineer does problem solving. They do upgrades. They tackle special situations. You might think of them as the car repair technician. Then we've got another level, the architect. They manage the big picture planning, like building out your IT infrastructure into new directions. They determine what the customer, and you're the customer, what the customer needs, and they address that accordingly. Think of this in the car world. This is the guy that designs the car. Now, it is rare that we will see desktop architects in small companies. But if you go to a large corporation, you may actually have someone who is designated at planning out how thousands of people will be migrating to the latest version of Microsoft Office or Windows or some other software. And let's get into some more esoteric positions as well. Change management specialist. Now, with this, I'll give you a quick story. One day, long ago, where I was working, someone took down a server during the middle of the day to change out the video card. This server was relied upon by a few hundred employees to do their daily work, and nobody knew that this server was going to be taken down except for this technician. A change management specialist ensures that the who, the what, the where, when, how, why, and any of that detail of any change will not affect more than just a few people. They ask that the outage be when people aren't using the server. They question the need to upgrade the video card, and they make sure that there are plans, communications, testing, and many more details known about this change. Then there's another one, the service management specialist. Okay, you call the service desk, but there are really so many different details behind the scenes. For instance, the different interdepartmental agreements about how fast the phones will be answered, the success rates of resolving the problem on the first call, and more. There are escalation and emergency response procedures that are planned out in advance. So when you call the service desk, aka the help desk, there are details on how to handle over 99% of the calls. They're documented and they're laid out by, yes, the service management specialist. One more here. ITIL specialist. ITIL? What? ITIL. It stands for Information Technology Infrastructure Library, or a series of ideas and thoughts about common sense and how it should apply to IT. Okay, so nerds are not known for common sense. If we're totally honest, common sense is uncommon in today's world. But ITIL lists out a number of the common best practices that go along with the change management specialist, the service management specialist, and, oh yes, the various administrators, engineers, and architects. They put this all together into one spot. It was invented up, I think it was in the 80s, over in England. And it's now becoming very popular here in the United States. I hope that fills in some of the blanks. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin.
Marty, you're moving. You're going to be transitioning your discussion to the return on investment on all these home automation products. Let's get to it.
For the past few years, I've been explaining how to go about designing a house that could dodge major repairs or replacements for 40 years, would be energy miserly to slow down the utility meters, and could integrate a cybernetic self-management system. Now, all that's very nice if you have a passion for these things and a lot of extra money to put into building a new house from scratch, but to give credit where it's due, Hank was one of the first to ask me if some of the tricks that I described to make the project house work might not also work for existing homes. So, for the past several months, that's where my attention has been. I've been looking into ways to retrofit existing homes to keep expensive repairs or replacements at bay and to pare down the energy bills. I'm framing up a lot of separate projects that could make sense to do with an existing home. And starting this spring, my weekly segments here will try to describe, case by case, the challenge we want to confront, the products and methods we'll choose to confront it, and what we expect the outcome to be. Until those segments begin, and most projects are likely to each involve several segments, I'm treating these next few months as a transition period and a chance to redefine our context, even, in fact, to shift it. The Scratch Build Project House originally was going to be in Aiken, South Carolina, where most of the challenges have to do with keeping things cool in extended hot weather. A lot more of this country's population lives in places with seasons and snow and ice, and all of the challenges that those things bring. So, right now, I'm somewhat farther north, seeking out a mid-size house and hoping to find one that's not more than 30 years old. Why? Because the construction materials and techniques in use over the past 30 years, and for that matter, the building codes, are better than what came before. That's not to say that your house needs to be under 30 for my examples to work for you. But since I'm paying for this house out of my own pocket, I want to make sure that I'm starting with something that won't be too old to endure when I'm too old to endure, meaning endure the costs, the work, and all that. So we'll have a house to work with, and it will be imperfect enough that the improvements I bring into it will involve the same levels of complexity or difficulty, and when done, benefits, that you might see if you decide to do the same things for your house. A lot of the first things I plan to do are things that are invisible to most people most of the time. I'll make them as visible to you as I can. And I've been in radio long enough to know how to help you see what I'm talking about. Do you like puzzles? I hope so, because that's sort of the way I'm planning these segments. The house does such and such, or you experience thus and so when you're in it. What does that mean? What's even possible to do about it? What are our choices? What are their trade-offs? And if we get really lucky, maybe we can get some bonus solutions to challenges we thought were unrelated. What do you buy? Who do you hire? How long will it take? How much will it cost? And what will you have when you're done? That's kind of how I'm modeling all this. The real work starts in the spring. Meanwhile, we'll spend the next several weeks, as I said, in a transition, and in a lot of those weeks, we'll consider some of what we know as a result of the big build project, the one that will never happen. And yes, there will be a little tech in the mix, too. So here are a few basic principles, the bumper stickers of this kind of approach. These are principles that you might want to keep in mind and maybe talk about. The first principle, stop losses. Losses? What losses? Well, until you ask, you can't possibly answer that. And until you answer it, well, you have to answer it or those losses will never stop. Second, and not unrelated, seal the envelope. The envelope is everything that separates indoors from outdoors on all six sides of the house and all around the clock. Third, cut the chains of consequence. If a bad thing happens because of something else that happens, either break the connection or figure out different ways to accomplish both things. I'll be pointing out this kind of linking when we get into some of the projects. Fourth, don't trust the term trivial. If something seems to have only a trivial impact on energy or comfort or longevity, don't dismiss it until you do the math and can confirm whether it's truly trivial or, in political speak, fake trivial. I'll get you wired into understanding that piece better, too. Fifth, don't spend the dough if the ROI says no. ROI is an economics term for return on investment. Among the projects I'll present, most will cost $2,000 or less, and I'll try to at least name and frame the ROI elements in the final segment about each project. That's where we're heading. Next week, instead of heading to CES, we'll talk about other surroundings.
Thank you, Marty.
Public service announcements. The following are computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. All these meetings are free and open to the public. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question.
The New York Amateur Computer Club has a presentation on In Facebook We Trust. They will be meeting on Thursday, January the 10th at 7 p.m. at NYU, 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, room 414 in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will meet Friday, January the 11th, 2019, 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Schur Hall, New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus in Old Westbury, New York. The Princeton PC Users Group will meet Thursday, January the 24th, 2019. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will meet Thursday, January the 24th, 2019. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m. in the Middletown Library Large Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has its meeting on Friday, February the 1st. Meeting time is 8 p.m. They meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad at 1916 Bartow Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. And finally, the Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on your digital afterlife. They'll meet Thursday, February the 7th, 2019. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, White Plains, New York. In the meantime, stay in touch, keep on computing, and remember to back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.